You're listening to Two Guys Talking Wine with Michael Pincus and Andre Prue.
Andre, we are here with Jose Rallo of Donna Fugata Winery in Sicily. It's one of my dreams to actually go to Sicily and check out the winery scene there. Jose, where does the name come from, first of all?
Donna Fugata means escaping woman or fleeing woman. And it was really a queen who escaped Naples and took refuge where now we have the vineyards.
Oh,
we could, yeah.
Okay, got it. All right, so fleeing women, got it. All right, so as I said, I really want to learn about Sicily and Sicilian winemaking, and we're hoping for a couple of wines to show up there. They're running a little late today, so we have nothing to taste at the moment, so we're really going to dive right in and talk about Sicily. So, first of all, how do you come to the wine scene? Let's start with you.
I'm part of a family winery, and my family started in 1851, so I'm the fifth generation, and this is, it's a legacy which is very important for all the values, but it's also a responsibility, because we are looking to the future, we are thinking about our son, our daughter, and we need to do better than our ancestors had done.
Very good. Okay. So 1851, so the fifth generation. And did you learn winemaking yourself, or are you in a different part of the wine aspect?
Really, I'm in charge of marketing activities, communication, and management control. So technique and emotion, rules, and some marketing. My brother, I'm a very lucky woman. My brother is in charge of all the technical stuff activities. So he's an agronomer and he's also an enologist. So he's following this kind of activities and sales. So we divided, the diverse activities.
So when you talk about wanting to do better than your ancestors, what do you mean by that?
Well, today we are speaking about a global market. Probably when my ancestors began, exporting means simply going from Sicily to UK or from Sicily to the United States. Now we have Asia, we have Australia and New Zealand that have started producing wine. So really the situation is much more complicated than in the past. And now we are also facing the climate changing conditions. So we must think about water resource and other resources that are not enough if we don't try to change and innovate our processes.
So how is climate, let's jump right into the climate change, because we were given that one. How has climate change affected some place like Sicily, which is already fairly warm?
Yeah, we can say that Sicily, it's in the warm part of the hemisphere, a little bit like California. We have a similar climate, and we have problem of water because we have something like drought, not yet, but we know that there can be problem of water. And we are also trying to fight for a bigger biodiversity. This is very important. And Sicily has 70 different native varieties, which is a great heritage, because some of these varieties are not cultivated anymore, but we make experimentation about them, and probably we can find a variety which is very good for drought, or maybe a variety which is more resistant to some disease. So experimentation is very important.
What are the main varieties that you work with?
Okay, so we have the king of the variety is the black variety, which is called Nero d'Avola. Nero d'Avola can be cultivated and produced all over Sicily, from the western part to the eastern part, which are very different. And so the it's producing different type of wine from this grape variety. Then we have some regional varieties. For instance, Mount Etna, which is the most active volcano in Europe, has typical grapes like Carricante and Nerello Mascalese. The southeast of Sicily, which is Vittoria DOC, has Frappato. So every region inside this continent, call it Sicily, it's really diverse and give different opportunities in terms of style of wine.
So you mentioned Mount Etna. If I'm not mistaken, it erupted again this summer, did it not?
Always okay, erupting.
So what does that mean for growing grapes? Are you constantly in a threat of ash, of lava, of what is the big problem with Etna?
Yes, exactly. Well, we must say that we also get opportunities because ashes, for instance, they are fertilizing the soil. So it's a good thing. And of course, when eruption is a little bit bigger, then it's a risk for people who are living there and also a risk for the vineyards. But the vineyards arrive up to 700 meters over the level of the sea. Usually the eruption comes down but doesn't go over the 1,500 meters in altitude. So they are quite two different worlds.
Okay. So one of our colleagues here in Canada wrote a book on volcanic soil, John Szabo, and what do you see as the benefit of volcanic soil to grapes?
Volcanic soils give an enormous different personality to the wines. We call it the minerality that we feel in the mouth, some notes that we feel with the nose. That these wines are really special. They have good acidity, and I can tell you that about Etna, the white wine have really a long, long shelf life. We're drinking a Carricante of about 30 years, 40 years, and they are very interesting wines.
So sorry, the soil composition affects the acidity in the grapes?
Yes, because the soil composition it's influencing also the life of the plant. So the process of the vegetation it's very important. The plant is influenced by the components of the soil.
Interesting. I never would have thought the soil to have an impact on acidity content. Does it play in with, I guess, altitude and just total degree growing days as well? Like,
yeah.
If you have volcanic soil versus non-volcanic soil, will one variety hold its acidity better if it's planted on a different type of soil versus what you have?
Yeah, I believe the first thing that you said before, it's a combination of factor that that allowed a bigger acidity. Is the altitude, is the soil, is the also the type of grape variety. So it's really a component, the whole factors determine these characters.
All right. So everybody tells me I have to go to Sicily. Everybody that I am that I talk to in Italy says I got to go to Sicily, and anybody who's been to Sicily says you got to go to Sicily. So, what is a typical day in Sicily? Is there such a thing, or is there no such a thing as a typical day in Sicily?
Allora, Sicily is worthy of travel. This is for sure. You can stay 1 week, but you can stay also 4 weeks, 1 month. It's really a place where you find culture, nature. You can go to the beach in the morning, and maybe you can go in the evening into a Greek theater and have a look at the special drama. Or maybe you can go near the Etna and have a look at the eruption, which is in the night is something incredible. And Sicily is also well known for food. We have, of course, a vegetarian dishes because we adore aubergines or peppers, something like that. But we love also cooking the fish that we fish every day. So there's a lot of raw ingredients that are fresh, that are cultivated in Sicily or just fished. And this make the food very unique.
And how does the wine and the food play into each other? Does the cuisine have an influence on what's grown and the approach to winemaking, and what's the historical like impact that this has had?
Allora, I will tell you something strange, but Sicily has a majority of white wines compared to the red wines. And I think this is because the food is mostly vegetarian, is mostly made on fish. So the white wines get very well along with this kind of dishes. Also, for the red wine, we like very much the grilled meat or fish. And you know that there are some type of red wine, for instance, the one of the southeast of Sicily, that are very soft in tannins and they don't need wood aging. So they are a type of red wines that we can serve slightly chilled. And this is also very interesting during summer to have this opportunity.
So you mentioned that the majority of wines are white, which is funny because a lot of the stuff that we see coming through the LCBO is red from Sicily. Why do you think, well, I don't know if it's the rest of the world or it's just the LCBO or Canada, why do you think the reds are, one, more popular, and two, that we don't see a lot of the white wines?
I really don't know. I know that in every country, the top of the consumption is about red wine. But I think that white wine can be also very diverse because you can have a fresh, crispy white wine for an aperitif or a salad, but you can have also older wines that have been aging in wood, or not only in wood, also in the bottle, which can be very complex and can be a pairing for more important food.
So I do have first of all, I should ask you, how big is the winery, Donna Fugata? And how many bottles do you make? What's your major wine? This is all those, you know, initial questions I should have been asking, but we got right into climate change. But how big is the winery in compared to other Sicilian wineries, etc.?
Well, Donna Fugata is cultivating 488 hectares, and we are cultivating in different part of Sicily. We were born in the western part, and then we moved to Pantelleria, which is a volcanic island between Sicily and North Africa. And then we moved to the eastern part on Mount Etna and in Victoria. So we are facing a harvest time, which is 100 days long. And this is very special for us, and I think also comparing to the other wineries. And then it's a family business. We cannot forget what is very important for family business. Know-how coming from 100 years of experience. It means a special passion, special interest in talking about wines, spreading the culture of wines, and thinking about the future. I think that good sustainable practice can be very much related to a family business, because the concept of the future is very much typical for the family business, like this winery and like also other wineries. It's very popular in Sicily and in Italy to find family business also in the wine industry.
I think it's interesting that that's the first time you've actually said the word sustainability. You got close to it when we were talking about the family. Learning from your ancestors. What does sustainability mean for Donna Fugata?
Yeah, okay. So first of all, for me, it's synonymous of future. Because first thing, we need to preserve the soils. Otherwise, we cannot produce anymore. So this is really important. We need water, because without water in a warm climate like in Sicily, you need irrigation, energy irrigation, we say, drop irrigation, but a little bit of water is important in July, especially to get the plant to produce new leaves, and so the ripening process can go on. Sustainability is also respect not only for the environment but also for the people. We are a winery with nearly 200 people working for us, 200 families working for us. So we must also really focus on the well-being of these people inside the winery, and what is also important is to fight against I cannot say racism, but the difference that sometimes we are making through men and women in at Donna Fugata. We are 43% of the leadership, of the leader position, are occupied by women. And this, I think, is very important, not only because we need to divide a 50-50%, but because we are plural, because it's important to listen to different opinions.
I think that's really important. And it's been interesting to see movement in the wine world, especially, I think, especially over the past couple of years, to start to include the human element in sustainability. In terms of the viticulture itself, like obviously dealing with changes in climate, like that we've already touched on, do you have any opinions on like organic, biodynamic? Like, is this something where, you know, I think in my opinion, you're farming out of a box. You get a manual and you're stuck to that. And depending on where you are, that might not be the answer to sustainability. Do you have any thoughts on that and any, I guess, specific viticultural practices?
Okay, so we are traditional conducting our vines. I think that there's always something to learn. There's always something to learn. Also, the traditional way of conducting the grapes can learn something from biodynamic or organic cultivation. We don't want to risk our quality. We want to be sure every year to get the healthiest grapes, the very good ripened grapes. So this is our choice. But I'm sure that everybody can do its job, and we are going to compare to those wines in terms of quality and also in terms of sustainability best practice. Why not?
See, that's what I like to hear in terms of sustainability. Like, I really think that we're at a point where a lot of these isms have more to do with marketing than they do with people who actually give a crap about the quality of their product, because that is a key part of building a business. And you and I, we've talked about that a bit. Like, we have wineries in Ontario that have quietly let their organic certifications lapse because you get to a point where you need to make sure people get paid and also make sure that the quality of the product is sustainable.
At the moment, they're just buzzwords. They really are. So people have to start living up to those.
Yep.
To those words. So now I don't know how to. I write a rosé report every year. I have for the last five, and one of your bottles showed up at the door. Although I had no idea it was yours, it was a rosé, and it said Dolce and Gabbana, and I was like, "How does Dolce and Gabbana get to my door?" And then I read at the back that it was your winery that makes it. How does that partnership come into existence?
Well, it's a fantastic experience that we are having with them. Dolce Gabbana has part of the roots in Sicily. The family Dolce is it was born in Sicily, and so they are looking for Sicilian enterprises who can be excellent, who can do high quality, and they like to make business with them. So we've been first good friends. We were their supplier into their restaurants, and after a while, maybe 2 or 3 years, they asked us to become a partner, which is a totally different thing comparing to co-branding. This is not really a co-branding, it's a partnership. We had to design especially wines for this partnership. So the first wine was a rosé, and it was a blend between Nerello Mascalese, which is cultivated on Mount Etna, and Nocera, which is cultivated in the western part of Sicily, because they asked for a unique blend. And we found it. My brother found it. So for us, for me, what I think is that working together with a company who is so much focusing on details, so much artisanal in their way of producing, for us it's really a very interesting opportunity to compare ourselves to these standards.
And what is, this is a kind of a personal question, what is your feeling on the future of rosé and rosé now?
Well, I think that in the past few years, rosé has been growing, and I adore rosé. Why? Because quality has been improving. Because probably 10 years ago, if you wanted to drink a rosé, there was nothing to. It was difficult to enjoy, you know? They were a little bit like last products.
It was an afterthought,
yeah. Exactly. Now the quality has increased, and so it's interesting to have a rosé that can you can use it for aperitif and all over the meal. I think it's very interesting wine. At this moment, it's my favorite style of wine.
I think it's a lot of people. Michael does his report every year where he does those work, but I mean, it probably doesn't hurt to have the Sicilian diet that you just talked about, you know, having fish and fresh vegetables as part of the core of the diet. Like, it's hard to get more rosé friendly than that.
Is there also a meat culture on Sicily as well, or not? Because I'm looking at the heavy reds that you have as well. There's got to be some kind of meat culture.
You just scared Michael away with the
vegetables.
Word vegetarian.
Yeah, you scared me there.
So
I got to get it back to the meat column.
Well, we...
I'm going to go no with that look. That's she's like, no, there is no meat culture. So,
no, not really meat culture. We're really moderate. We are curious. We like to eat everything. We are not fanatic.
All right. So my next question is, they always say that every part of Italy has a pasta. What is the pasta of Sicily?
Now I will surprise you, because it's not really a pasta. We call it couscous.
Oh,
it has
okay.
Arabic origins. And in my terroir, where I live in Marsala, we prepare it with fish soup. So it's not really the couscous that you have in North Africa, but it's a different one. It's more refined, more elegant. We make a rich fish soup with all different fishes coming from a rocky sea, and so we cook this pasta with the soup of the fish, and it's coming something very, very special.
We'd like to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, really.
You know, Michael, we're now together a couple days after we sat down with Jose. I still just love your reaction when she talked about Sicilian cuisine and focused on the vegetables, and you were just like, is there any meat?
I just didn't see that because, you know, you think of Sicilian wines, you think of all those reds that they have. They're big, the Nero d'Avola, and they seem that they would have more meat-focused cuisine.
Yeah, but I mean, you can also have those big reds like next to things like tomatoes have a lot of tannin when they're cooked a certain way, things like that. We're going to be tasting through a bunch of the wines here, but I guess just to clarify a little bit about like some of the stuff I said in the interview with the questions. I'm a big fan of transparent winemaking, and I'm not trying to crap on any of the biodynamic farmers or any of the organic farmers, but I think we're at the point now where, especially like paying attention to what happens in Ontario year in and year out, that we need to acknowledge that just because something is labeled organic or something is labeled biodynamic, it doesn't necessarily mean it's superior. And being able to talk about conventional farming, if that's what suits your climate, is something I think a winery should be open to do. And honestly, it made me happy to see Jose bring that conversation to the table.
Yeah, it was interesting that your reaction to it was because you suddenly brightened up. And
well, it was also I was trying to play off her body because I could see her physically get a little defensive when the line of questioning started to go about the conventional farming, because I think that is something where a lot of wineries get backed into a corner when they're talking about their farming practices, and they're not farming to an ism, right? They're not organic, they're not biodynamic, they're not dancing in the moonlight before they harvest their grapes. Like, they're just farming.
But everybody likes dancing in the moonlight.
So we've got our hands on the wines.
Yeah, there's six wines. We've got one sparkling, one sweet, and then we have two white, two red. These would have been the wines.
Sparkling is a Millis Amato. It's a Chardonnay Pinot Noir traditional method sparkling, which I do find interesting, like to have Chardonnay Pinot Noir planted when you have all the indigenous varieties available.
I find that kind of interesting as well. When talking to Jose afterwards, because I stuck around for a lunch, and I was talking to her about that, and she had mentioned that it had been Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. It seemed very odd that they would, but obviously if you're going to make a quality sparkling wine, then obviously you're going to want to bring Chardonnay and Pinot Noir into the mix.
The intensity on this wine, it's not often that you open a bottle of sparkling wine and you can smell it right out of the neck of the bottle. I popped this cork and immediately got like a little flourish of like pear. It doesn't taste like pear, but like I just got this like really great aroma of like freshly baked bread and orchard fruit getting into the glass. It's very biscuity.
Yeah, I like the biscuity notes to it. You said no pear, but I get a little bit of that on the palate. More of a bosque.
It's muted on the palate. Where out of the bottle, like when I popped that cork, yeah, it was like, poof.
Yeah, you.
Hello, I'm pear.
But I don't mind this as a sparkling.
I love it.
I think I'd like just a touch more acidity in here.
Yeah,
but it's quite flavorful.
Okay, so we both commented on the acidity on the first tasting because, to full disclosure, we tasted this before we hit record, and I made a quick comment on the acid, and then your response was, "Well, it's Sicily. What do you expect?"
Correct. So yeah, so you don't expect.
I think there's more acid than your typical Californian wine here.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. I don't think I would not drink it. Does that make sense?
How much are they selling it for? I'd spend $40 on that, easy.
You'd have to look it up.
Okay, we'll look at the pricing after and include that in the show notes. But I guess we're busting out the old thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yeah, I think that seems to work on the podcast better than anything else. I'm a thumbs up for it.
I'm a enthusiastic thumbs up on this.
I do enjoy
something
that
I wasn't expecting from Sicily, right?
No. No, when you see a sparkling from Sicily, and you don't see a lot of sparkling from Sicily.
You don't see anything from Sicily at the LCBO.
Well, you see some, but you see a lot of
Etna Rosso.
Well, you see Etna Rosso. You see anyway. So this next one is called Athelia.
Yeah,
and a lot of their labels have to do with art, because they're art and wine, and that's what they're all about.
Yeah, I like the concept of the labels. I'm not a... Now that Jose isn't here, I guess I can say this. I'm not a big fan of like this style of artwork.
Yeah, she can't get mad at you now. Okay. Yeah, you be you, boo. I don't mind it. It's not going to make me buy the bottle or not. It's going to be what's inside the bottle that's going to get me.
Hmm. Oh. Okay, so when Jose was talking about the Sicilian diet, like, this is definitely something I'm picturing. Like, I looked up the recipe for the couscous pasta that she talked about using the fish broth and just seafood-based couscous there. And, like, I think this wine is, like, begging to be paired with, like, shellfish, seafood. I see they're going with the couscous. Like, it's just got this, like... It's a soft acid, but it's still got like a nice like
there is some palate cleansing there is some acid to this. I like this. I think it's a hot day kind of wine. There's a lot of citrus notes to it.
I find it more floral. Like, it's super super like honeysuckle.
I'll give you the honeysuckle
white flower, like spring dew,
like early morning, like flower and pollen.
I'm getting citrus zest on that finish.
Yeah, lime zest specifically. So, I don't think this is terribly expensive if I remember from the price list. I'm actually glad that we're tasting this without the price list, so we're kind of getting...
I sometimes prefer to taste without a price list.
This is one where if it's $20, like $20 to $25.
If I'm not mistaken, this is the one that going through the LCBO, so it's $18.95, something like that. So
score, that's, really great.
That's a really nice wine.
Yeah, really great spring sipper for that price.
Yeah, I'll give you a... I'm also a thumbs up on that one.
Me too.
I like...
$18.95.
Yep. Yeah, I like how that one sits on the palate. I can see myself sitting in Sicily.
Geez, I wish.
Kind of enjoying a nice hot day.
I think you may have asked the wrong question as well in terms of meat culture, because I seem to remember there being like a Sicilian... Sicilian like salami being a thing. Maybe I'm imagining things. Like I know I love Calabrese salami, and Calabria is pretty far south, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they I'm sure they have sausages and things like that. It's Italy, right? They always have sausages.
Ooh, this actually smells really really similar to the last one, but with more intensity. It's an Etna Bianco.
So this is an Etna Bianco sul Vulcano. Etna Bianco.
If I'm not mistaken, sur volcano means on the volcano. Oh my god, this is gorgeous.
Okay, so
wow, this is a really really nice wine. I almost think that we would probably do it more justice in a larger glass. It's crunchy. It's like very minerally. It's got that like white flour. It's not rose petal at all. It's just really lovely, like, summer day. I know, like, I think it's become fallen a little out of fashion to say summer in or sunshine in a glass, but, like, this...
Summer in a glass.
This really does feel like, you know, walking on a hillside on a hot summer day.
I'm less excited by this one than you are, I think. You know, I'm getting the minerality. I'm getting the... I'm getting the floral. It's got a little bit of weight to it. I bet you there's some lees contact here for sure.
I wouldn't be surprised if this was either in neutral barrel or even some light oaking on it.
I guess that's more of a food wine. Like this is definitely your wine for the for those vegetarian dishes that we're talked about, I guess.
I think this one where I disagree with you. For me, this is like a really nice just kind of sit and sip on it.
Mm.
But like I said, we're drinking this out of a white wine glass. I really want to get this into a burgundy glass just because I think there's a little bit more to reveal with it. Can you pass me the Bordeaux glasses there? I'm going to give mine a shot in the Bordeaux glass before we move on to the next one.
Throw the Bordeaux.
Open the next wine, though.
All right.
Okay. So Sul Volcano.
I'm going to open the companion to the Sul Volcano.
So Sul Volcano. Are you thumbs up or thumbs down? And remember, there's no waffling. It's either up or down.
No. I know that. I am going to be. Oh, now you put it in the big glass, and now you say it's even better than that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to ask you to give me a splash then. You've got the bottle, so you're going to have to splash it in there. So, I am thumbs down from a small glass. So here we go.
Alright, Michael's taking a sip. He's doing the swirl. A little bit of oxygenation in his mouth. Moved it from cheek to cheek. He's going and revisiting. Oh, no. And it's going into the spittoon.
Thumbs down for Michael.
That's really too bad.
Yeah, I'm not that big a fan.
You know, more people should really do play-by-plays of people tasting wine.
Really? That's really what people should be doing?
Yeah, I think at least on this podcast.
Yeah, if Dan Shulman did it, I think it'd be all right.
Is Dan Shulman another like old-timey reference that I should get?
What are you talking about? Dan Shulman does the broadcast for the Blue Jays.
On AM radio?
No, on TV. You got to watch the baseball, my friend.
You know what? I would watch baseball, but yeah, I just got my bathroom refinished. I'm going to go watch some paint dry.
Yeah, that sounds like you.
All right, Sil Volcano.
If you want to give Andre some hell, get mad at him for not knowing who Dan Schulman is. He's Canadian too, for God's sake.
Okay, but I love how you keep like busting out these cultural references that are like
they're not old at all. He's doing it now. Jeez. Okay, so this is Etna Rosso. This is the Sul Volcano. This is 2021. I am not a big fan of the plastic cork.
Plastic or sugar cane? That's sugar cane.
So I'm not really 100% sure, but I know that at the lunch, Dona Fugata did mention that they are doing their part for recycling plastic.
Okay, so this might actually be... Oh, yeah.
Okay, so it might be what's called... what do they call it? Ocean-bound plastic?
Okay, so this is one where... I understand your skepticism. I'm not going to yell and scream with you, but I do think plastic as a closure is a bad idea.
I do too, and it makes me sad when I heard they were doing this. So, anyway, that's just a personal aside. I really hope this wine is good.
Mm.
I'm liking the nose on it.
I'm finding the nose muted. I'm finding, if anything, it's throwing more savory and smoke. I'm not getting a lot of fruit from it.
I would agree with you.
The mineral isn't what I would want from, like, a volcanic red, which is usually a little bit more, like, crunchy gravel. And this just, it smells more like it doesn't even smell like mineral. Like, it smells like dirt.
Yeah, the Sul Volcano range is not doing it for me. I'm not a big fan. This I'm also a thumbs down on.
You're gonna speak for me now?
I am. Well, I'm going with it.
I mean it's thumbs down, but I didn't say it. Like,
no, I'm getting right out there and saying that one. So far, my favorite still seems to be the Athelia. I really like that white, followed by the sparkling. But this is the big gun. Nice. This is the big gun. This is their Mila e una notte, 1001 nights.
I love watching you read labels now. I know I'm not far behind you. Like, just so you know, like, I got diagnosed this year with needing reading glasses, but I got fancy contact lenses that let me do it. For anyone listening at home, the reason why Michael always pauses before reading a wine label is because he has to adjust his whole body so he can read a wine label.
I got to make sure the glasses are on just right.
Mille e una notte. It's a 2020. Sicilia Rosso. Or sorry, yeah, Sicilia DOC Rosso. So I'm guessing this is a blend of indigenous grapes.
I would think so. We should take a look. I don't think it says here on the back.
Okay, so, oh wow, so this is available at the LCBO as well, and they sell this for $100 a bottle.
Okay, so.
Thank you for getting this bottle for us. I was actually on the website taking a look that Dona Fugata also makes wine for Dolce & Gabbana. Dolce & Gabbana.
Yes.
Jesus.
Yes, we talked about that on the podcast and about how that came about. So two very Sicilian...
Thank you for like reminding me of the interview we did earlier this year that I'd forgotten part of.
So...
Oh, nice. Okay, so this...
This.
I actually wish I didn't know the price of this before smelling it.
At the lunch, they served this with a tenderloin,
not vegetables.
Not vegetables. I was very happy to see some meat, and this wine was one of those that I really liked. So I hope now that I'm not sitting with a big steak in front of me, that I still enjoy it.
Yeah, tannin is pretty high, but it's short tannin, so it's not too aggressive on the back palate. There is a lot of fruit on the nose, which is making me happy. Like black cherry, amari cherry. It's a cacophony of a variety of cherries. For me, it's just like, but it's not confected. It's like it's fresh. It's juicy. It's
alcohol,
vibrant.
Remember Sicily?
I think it's a 14.
13 and a half.
I'm guessing it's 14.
Probably closer to 14, but I think this it's well balanced. Like, yeah, there's not a lot of crazy alcohol notes on it. There's no smell of alcohol. There's no real taste of alcohol.
Okay, this definitely has the potential to drink now, but it needs a decanter.
Oh, but they were saying at the lunch that they've had 20-year-old bottles, 30-year-old bottles.
And remember, like, that's the thing that bothered me about Abruzzo. Like, you're 50 now?
Yeah.
Like, do you really want to be waiting until you're 70 to drink a bottle of wine like this?
No. I think it's a little more approachable.
Like for me a wine like this is very close to the sweet spot. I think to drink it where I like it, like, as someone who, although you and I need to revisit this later this year, I'm finding myself developing an affinity for older wines.
As you do, as you get older, you'll start liking older wines.
But
when you can pull your back sitting on the toilet, that is the time.
Okay, so that
when you will know.
So that happened this week, and thanks for outing me on that. My back is in a tremendous amount of pain. No, but like
when you finally do that, you are getting to an age where you appreciate older wine.
But I think for me, it's like I've never gotten a taste for coffee. Right. Like, I'm a tea, I'm a tea drinker. Well, yeah. So, like, Bordeaux varietals and Bordeaux wines that are old have never really made me super excited. But I've been getting my hands on some older Pinot, and, oh, baby, like, talk about seductive. Like, older Pinot is just something that, like, has been making me really, like, oh, baby.
Tingle?
Oh, yeah. It's giving me the fizz.
It's making your back hurt.
It's making my back hurt. Yeah. Anyway, so coming back to the Donna Fagata Mille e Una Notte 2020. This is a solid thumbs up for me.
Well, absolutely a thumbs up. But you know, as it sits in the glass, we've got the big Bordeaux glasses going here. There are some coffee notes here. There are some mocha notes here. But there is a lot of that big fruit.
For me, the fruit overpowers everything else, which I think is amazing. And the tannin is bringing up the finish. And this is one where, man, like, this would have to be Tomato City to, like, rise up to
those tannins are really starting to settle in on the gums.
But they're short and fine. They're short and fine, which I think definitely helps this out.
But definitely a big thumbs up on on this.
This is gorgeous. So that's really gorgeous wine.
So we have one more, and it is a sweetie, and this is the Ben Rea or Ray.
I don't know, the way I would say that with the accent on the E is Rae.
I remember asking her, and she told me, and I was like, yeah, I'm still not going to get it right, no matter how hard I try.
Come on, don't you spend like a quarter of your year in Italy?
Yeah, but I don't think Ben Rye or Ben Ray or Ben whatever it is I don't know if that's truly Italian or if it's something in the Sicilian dialect or.
Look at you making excuses.
Correct. I can make the excuses with some of the best. So this is a sweetie, and I've had this a couple times before, not this vintage, but it's one of those Passito wines that they make. Everybody okay,
can
seems
you can
to make
you refresh
one.
My memory on Passito?
So again, it's a dried grape thing. Oh yeah, let's smell that. It smells like bourbon raisins.
Bourbon raisins.
Yeah.
Yeah. It smells like apple fruit leather.
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot going on here.
Ooh, apricot on the palate. Ooh, man.
Honeyed apricot. There's a nice acidity going on here.
Can we make...
There's a little bit of spice.
Can we make sweet wines cool again?
I wish we could. I really do. I love port. I love sweet sherries.
I don't even want to tell you. So,
but I mean, I'm not a big ice wine fan. I know we're Canadian. We're supposed to love ice wine, but I don't really love ice wine in any way, shape, or form. I'll be honest with you.
I have a soft spot for ice wine, but with regard to port, I just want to give like a hot tip to anybody listening to this right now: is the Kopke Late bottle vintage 2018 port that's been rolling through the LCBO. It's like $15 and change a bottle.
Yeah.
You know, we've had the up and down weather, and when it went down, I went and bought three bottles of it, and I don't have three bottles of it anymore.
Oh, yeah. Kupke makes some good port. So,
and I mean, at that price, like, you know, I know Taylor, I think we consider like Taylor Fladgate almost a friend of the podcast at this point because of Lindsay Grove's fantastic, I guess, former wine writer, and has been really great at making sure we're connected with Taylor's, is still a little bit more money than Kopke. It's like, where else can you get a wine of that quality for $16, right?
Yeah, this is just a really nice Pasito.
It's got like a really nice cereal note on the finish. Yeah. Like, what's in my mouth? It's almost like...
There's a lot going on.
Did you ever eat shredded wheat as a kid, like with warm milk?
Not with warm milk. I always did the iced, and but you know what? I still like. I still like mini wheats.
Ooh, or Weetabix. Do you ever have Weetabix?
Weetabix, I had, but again, not warm, but cold.
So in my house, my mom would tell us we would warm the milk up in the fridge.
Yeah,
and I know this is a very, for everyone at home, I apologize. This is going to be a very specific tasting note, but I'm just having a moment where I'm being taken back to being like 12 or 13 years old. It's cold in Saskatchewan. My mom has put the breakfast together. It's like three biscuits of Weetabix, like a tablespoon of brown sugar, and we hit it with warm milk. And then when you stir the bowl, the Weetabix turns into like almost like a porridge. And the finish on this Ben Rae, the Pasito, feels just like that. It's a cold winter day in Saskatchewan with that little bit of relief at the end of like shoveling snow.
So I'm going to bring you to something a little bit more recent. The folks at Kellogg's made some mini wheats that was a limited edition honey flavor. And I picked up a little bit of that. And that's kind of where I am on this one. I will give you that little kind of wheat, that shredded wheat kind of note.
But that's it, though. It's just like, I just love that we're kind of both in the same place, but like tying it to something that's really personal. And the thing is, like, I love Highland Scotch. Glenfarclas. I love the Glenfarclas whiskeys because, I don't know, it's just like you put an ice cube in like a Glenfarclas 12 or 15, you let the ice cube melt a bit, and it tastes like frosted flake milk to me. Like the finish note on it is just like, come on, cereal milk is just one of those like great things on the planet.
There are. I remember different ones than you do, but Frankenberry always made a good milk. I'll tell you that. So
okay, so this Ben Rae. Okay, so that, now here's a challenge, and this is why sweet wines aren't cool. When would we drink this? How would we drink this? What would be the situation?
Well, right now. Like, I think people really dig into sweet wines after they taste them.
Yeah.
Right? And then you get all excited, and you taste it, and you probably would run out and buy a couple of bottles of this, and you'd go, yeah, I love it. I'm going to have all kinds of fun with that. And then you just don't. Do you know what I mean? That is the problem with sweet wine, is I think at the end of a night, end of a dinner, if you're at home, more people will go open another bottle of wine. Nobody ever says, hey, what do you got that's sweet? You know, nobody ever says that. And there's points where maybe we should be thinking that way, but we don't.
You know what? This is something I've started doing because, like, as I've mentioned on the podcast many times, I'm growing my wine collection. I'm still just buying stuff. And, like, I've started to buy stuff at random. Like, and some of the stuff I've been buying has been Sauternes. I've been lucky enough to not buy ice wine. There's enough ice wine samples that have rolled through here. But, like, I like ice wine with some age on it. But with Sauternes, if I see something that says Grand Cru Class A and it's not Dechem, like if it's one of the Grand Cru Class A's and it's like $20 or $30 a bottle, I'm buying it. Like we're talking about the 200 mil bottles. Yeah. I'm buying it just like, because why not? Like, how bad is that wine gonna be when you let it age? Like it's not gonna be bad.
Let it go. Yeah.
So I think if you're listening to this, homework from Michael and I, go buy a bottle of sweet wine.
Sweet wine.
And like, don't drink it right away if you don't want to, but like, I don't know, buy the Kopke Lake bottle of vintage port, you're going to drink it right away.
You know what? Now that I think about it, I got a whole bunch of fruit wines and sweet wines back in the cellar. Maybe going forward, I should pull out like six or eight, and we should do a tasting of older sweet wines of some sort.
Do we want to get someone back for Stump the Chump and just completely destroy their palate that night?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's what you want to do, or you just want to, you know, get into some sweet wines. Were they worth aging? Were they not worth aging?
All right. So this Pasito, that's a big thumbs up for
me. Big thumbs up from me.
Yeah.
The Mila e Una Notte.
Big thumbs up.
Big thumbs up. The Sul di Vulcano.
The Etna Rosso Red was the only one that was two thumbs down.
Two thumbs down. We were split on the Sul Vulcano White.
Yeah.
Bianco.
But better in a bigger glass.
The Amphilia.
Amphilia.
Both two thumbs up. And for the sparkling.
Two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up as well. So that'll do it for us. And we'd like to thank Jose for being on the podcast.
And being upfront and honest about viticultural practices. Something I think is the solution in the future of the wine world. Like, it's not voodoo or witchcraftery. It's telling people what you're doing in the vineyard and letting them make their choice about whether they want to buy your wine from that.
And thank you for Dandaran for hooking us up with both the wine and Jose. I am Michael Pincus of MichaelPincusWineReview.com. You can find me on social media as The Grape Guy. Andre, what do you got to say?
My name is Andre Wine Review. I am AndreWineReview.ca. You can find me at AndreWineReview. And you can donate to this podcast at patreon.com/twoguystalkingwine. I know many of you have heard us say this. If you thought about donating but haven't in the past, like, we'll be honest, our donors go up and down. Lately, we've had a couple go down. It is not expensive to make this podcast, but we are working hard to make the podcast sound as good as possible. We've made investments in equipment. We've made, like, this is money that is not helping Michael and I live high on the hog. And yes, we're really lucky to have access to these fantastic wines. But at the same time, inflation, folks, help out your friendly local neighborhood wine writer, and considering helping them out on patreon.com/twoguystalkingwine.
We do appreciate it. And as always, good night.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to Two Guys Talking Wine on iTunes.
Two Guys Talking Wine is produced by Jim Ray, Adam Duran, and Ken Little.